All right, you may have a seat. That sounded awesome. It was so good to hear everybody's voices singing praise to Jesus there. Thanks, team. My name's Tim. Everybody, hey, good to see you. Anybody at home, good to not see you. You can see me. I want to encourage you, if you're watching at home, why don't you come join us in person 1 week? It would be great to see you and invite you deeper into community. So, like I said, my name's Tim. We're going to be continuing our Moses series today. We're going to be in Moses chapter 17. We'll look at verses 8 to 16. So if you have a Bible, won't you please open it up so that you can follow along once we get to it. Personally, I've been loving this journey through Exodus. It's been reminding me of themes that have always been there. And I feel like I'm learning and growing, and it's encouraging me. And it's challenging me, and it's holding up a mirror so I can see myself more clearly and resonate with, hey, I'm just like Israel, and my God hasn't changed. And we trust that for some of you, it's having the same effect, that God's using it in your spiritual life to grow you, to stretch you, to spur you on. So I want to encourage you of something this morning that I thought of this week. Here's my encouragement. Before we even get going, why not make it a practice every week before coming to church or watching us online to sit and to pray and to ask God to prepare your heart to receive his word that he might use it to change us and transform us? Okay, there's my challenge. Prepare yourself before you come on a Sunday morning so that when you come, you're expectant. You're anticipating meeting with the Lord and hearing from him, so that his spirit will ignite and spark something in your heart, and you will leave different than you came. There's my encouragement for you. Don't just come to church on Sunday and listen to a sermon. Prepare your heart and see what God will do with it. So here's where we are in our story in Exodus chapter 17. God's led his people out of slavery in Egypt. Miraculously, right? The Red Sea, I preached on that a couple weeks ago. He saved them decisively from the Egyptians there at the Red Sea. He crushed their enemies. Then he leads them out into the wilderness. Well, in the wilderness, he's teaching them. They are his saved people now, and he's teaching them what it means to live as his saved and redeemed people. So they are in the wilderness now. Last week, Jamie preached on how, while they were in the wilderness, they got hungry. And they grumbled. They got hungry, and God taught them a lesson on his provision. And God said, hey, you're going to be hungry. Don't worry. I'm going to provide for you. I saved you, and I'm going to keep providing for you. I'm going to meet your needs. And then today, what we're going to see is Israel coming up against their first external threat, the Amalekites. The first time a nation stands before them, and they're threatened in battle, and they're going to see God teach them that they can trust them against their enemies. Okay, so that's where we're going to be going today. So let's get into Exodus chapter 17, verses 8 to 16. I'm going to read it, and then I'm going to pray, then I'll just retell the story, pointing out things that will help our understanding of it, and then we will apply it, because I think there's stuff in here for us this week. Here's what it says. Exodus 17, 8 to 16 says, then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed, and whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it while Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun, and Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar, and he called the name of it, the Lord is my banner, saying, a hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. This is the word of the Lord. Please pray with me. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for what you said to the original readers of this word. And I pray, Father, that by your Spirit today, you would say something to us through this. That you would take these words and you would implant them in our hearts, that we might be confident that we heard from you. Would you encourage those who need it, and would you challenge those who need it today? For the glory of your Son, Jesus. Amen. Amen. So here's Israel. They're camped at a place called Rephidim, which is the same place where right before this, we skipped over this part, Israel was thirsty, and they grumbled against God again. There's their pattern. They get hungry, they grumble. They get thirsty, they grumble. They quarrel with Moses. And God told Moses, take a staff, strike a rock, and water came out of the rock. And God provided water for them. That's what happens right before this. This is at the same place called Rephidim that they actually renamed to mean bitter and quarreling and grumbling as a memorial to Israel's craziness there. They kept forgetting that God would provide for them. This is a lesson they had to learn over and over and over, that we learn over and over and over in our lives as well. So they're in Rephidim. They've been living in relative peace and ease, right? Their Egyptian enemies had been destroyed. Here they are. It's just them and God in the wilderness. Relative peace, no enemies coming upon them. And here, all of a sudden, it seems like out of nowhere, it says Amalek shows up to fight with them. So here they are. All of a sudden, boom, enemy in front of them. First battle. What are they going to do? They weren't warriors, these guys, as we're going to see. And you might be wondering, who's Amalek? Who are these people called the Amalekites? Well, they were distant relatives of the Israelites. Amalek was Esau's grandson. If you're familiar with the Old Testament, you have Jacob and Esau. Jacob was renamed Israel. Esau's grandson was Amalek. So these were distant relatives of the Israelites who kind of became a nomadic peoples who went around terrorizing other nations trying to plunder their wealth. They were opportunistic. They'd move all around, and if they saw a nation that had stuff, they'd sneak up on them, and they would start fights with them to get their stuff. That's what the Amalekites did. That's what they were known to do. They were opportunistic. They used shady tactics in battle. Listen to the way the author of Deuteronomy describes this particular event. In Deuteronomy chapter 25, which is a passage of Deuteronomy that God gives various laws to his people, and this is what he says regarding this event. Deuteronomy 25, 17 to 18, which fills it out a little bit more and helps us to understand what's going on. It says, remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came up out of Egypt, how he attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary, and he cut off your tail, those who were lagging behind you, and he did not fear God. So Israel had been out there, and the Amalekites come, and they look on the outside of the Israelite camp, and they look for the weak and the vulnerable and the isolated and the old and the children, and it says they cut off their tail. They started picking those people out that were on the fringes of the community. When that started to happen, which is really reprehensible when you think about it, that's not how to fight, is it? You look for the weakest and you try to take them out? But that was their enemy here. They were going to strike. They were going after the low-hanging fruit. Now, Moses sees this happen, and he goes to Joshua. It's the first time we read about Joshua in the Bible. He's going to become a pretty prominent figure as Moses' successor. The name Joshua means Yahweh saves, or Yahweh's salvation. And actually, to go a little bit further, the name Joshua in Hebrew is the same name that in Greek is translated Jesus. So Moses goes to Joshua and he says, Joshua, get some men together and go fight these guys. Get some men together. Now remember, the Israelites had been enslaved in Egypt as brickmakers for 400 years. They had never fought a battle before. They had never had to fight. They didn't go out of Egypt with all these spears and swords and gold and armor and battle wares, right? They just fled out of Egypt. Here they were, unprepared for battle. And Moses tells Joshua, go find some men. Go pick some men out of the 600,000 or whatever men that we're told are there at the time. Now, we don't get the sense that he says, go find the best warrior. We think what Moses is telling Joshua here is just Go find some guys that can fight. Maybe go walk around and said, you look between 20 and 50. You look fit. I bet you could hold a pointy thing and go up against our enemy, right? I'll take anybody. Who's willing to fight? I'll take you. So Joshua goes around looking for people. Now, what we're supposed to realize here is that they were no match for the Amalekites, right? These Amalekites, this is what they did. They fought. The Israelites, they didn't fight. This was something new for them. They were unprepared. They were undergunned. They were ill-equipped. So the next day, Joshua goes into battle. You got to picture it, right? We got to picture these Old Testament stories like you're watching a movie. You need to see the scene. There's the battle. It's misty. And the two armies are going out against each other. And as they're going and they're staring at each other in the eyes, Moses goes up on a hill with Aaron and Hur. Hur, according to Josephus, is Aaron's brother-in-law, Miriam's husband. So Aaron goes up on the hill with his two brothers, and he takes the staff of God, which if you have been following in the story, you know is that same staff that struck the Nile and turned it into blood. It was that same staff that struck the rock and water came out of it. It was that same staff that Moses held over the Red Sea, and it went woof. That staff that symbolized the power of God. Wherever that staff went was a reminder to God's people how powerful their God was. He could do anything. So Moses takes that staff and his brothers up on the hill, and while he's up there, he lifts up his hand, or maybe both hands, holding that staff above his head for the Israelites to see. When they're in that battle fighting their enemy, they're taking punches, they're getting annihilated, they look up the hill and they see the staff of God raised high. Moses holding that thing up. And it says whenever Moses put his arms down, when they got tired, then Israel started to lose the battle. And whenever his arms were up, Israel was winning the battle. And Moses' arms got tired. It says his arms got weary and he couldn't hold them up anymore. He was an 80-year-old man, right? I don't know if you've ever tried just holding your hands in the air and see how long you can go. I can't last very long. I consider myself fairly fit, but I could do this maybe 10 minutes before I'm giving up. So Moses' arms are up, they're down. I don't know, maybe he's playing a game saying, winning, losing, but I doubt it. I doubt that Moses would have done that in this instant, but it would have been funny, but probably unrealistic. So his arms are tired. His brothers recognize that he's growing weary. Or Moses asked them for help. We don't know. They get a rock. They plunk Moses down on that rock. And they go one on either side, and they hold his arms up for him. One on each side. So that his arms, the staff of God, can stay upraised for the people to see. And he holds his arms up. They help hold his arms up until the sun goes down. And then it says, Joshua and the army overtook the Amalekites with the sword. And they won. Israel won that battle. Now, here's the question. Who ultimately won that battle? Was it Joshua and the army that were down in the trenches fighting? Was it God? His power? Was it when the staff was raised high, miraculously the enemies were being wiped out? Or was it God's people saw the staff and they got courage and they fought harder? We don't know who won this battle. God or Joshua? Who gets the credit? Well, we learn from the story that according to Moses, God gets the credit for winning the battle. But it does say Joshua and the army overtook them with the sword. It's kind of one of those weird passages where you get the sense that God ultimately did it, but the people had a part to play too. They had to fight. Even though all they really needed was a staff, and they God could have just won through them. That's what happened in all the other times where Moses used the staff. God's people were kind of passive in that. God just did it with the staff. This is the first time where God's staff goes into battle, and the people have to do something too. They have to fight. But ultimately, God was the victor. We know that because Moses builds an altar to God there. And he says, let's call this altar, the Lord is my banner. So that it can be a memorial forever. When we think of a banner, we think of what pops up on our internet browser when we're searching for things, right? There's a banner that pops up, or we think a flag is a banner, or we think a banner is what you see an airplane taking a message through the air with, right? They're dragging the big sign behind them, the big banner. I saw one of those the other day. It reminded me of this story. But the banner here that it's talking about isn't a flag. It isn't a pop-up on your internet browser. It isn't something dragged behind a plane. The banner in context here is a signal pole. It was a military, a decorated pole that was used to signal an army. When the army was in battle, they were to look at the banner, the big long pole that they could all see, and they could see where the general was moving that signal pole. And they would rally around that banner, and they would follow that banner anywhere that it would go because they were taking their cues from that banner. So Moses here builds the altar, and he says, "The Lord is my banner." We're going to remember that it was the Lord who led us in this battle, and we're going to revolve our lives around him. We're going to rally around him. We're going to remember how he gave us the victory here. And he tells Moses to write down everything that happens that Joshua remembers to wipe out the Amalekites. So these pesky Amalekites are going to come back later, and when Israel's getting further into Canaan, they're going to fight with the Canaanites against the Israelites. The language seems a little bit harsh here of how badly God wants them to wipe these particular people out, but we need to remember these are the first people that came up against God's people. They were the first. You need to remember their reprehensible tactics, how they came for the weakest. They were standing in the way of God's people walking into the promised land, the place that he wanted to give them. So he tells Joshua, watch out for these guys forever, because they're going to be pesky. They're not going to want to leave you alone. Now, here's our story, right? Here's what happened. They won the battle, ultimately. God won it for them. They fought. What do we do with all of this? What do we do with this story? Do we just leave it here? Is it just a nice story? Up, down, win, lose, win, lose. No. I think when we ask, what does this have to do with God and us? And we bring it into today. Here's where we're sitting. If you know Jesus, you like the Israelites right now, where you're living your life, the ground of your life is between God saving you when you had faith in Jesus and his cross. He saved you. You are saved because of that. And one day you know you're getting to the promised land, right? Glory. It's coming. And right now in the in-between, you're learning to live as one of those saved, redeemed people. That's the ground that you live on right now, just like Israel was living here. They knew they were saved. That wasn't going to change, but they had to live in the space between where they knew they were going. That's where you live now. If you know Jesus, you're living in the in-between. And we need to understand this. In the in-between, like Israel, we're in a battle. Today, there's a battle raging right now. And it's not a physical one. It's not the church, Christians of the world, battling another nation standing in front of them. We don't need to fight with swords like they did in the Crusades and all that stuff. We don't need to do that. It's a spiritual battle that's being raged right now. A spiritual battle. Ephesians 6 tells us so. Ephesians 6, 10 to 13 is going to be familiar to a lot of you. But it says this, finally be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. Okay, Israel faced the Amalekites. Paul's saying it's the devil is the enemy. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. It's not a physical battle, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand firm. So there's a battle raging, and it's not a physical one, it's a spiritual one. And this is the context that we live in right now. In the space between salvation and eternity. And the enemy is the devil. The enemy isn't your neighbor who ticks you off. The enemy isn't a person, per se, that's standing in front of you that you might be angry with. The enemy is the devil who's influencing that person. He's the enemy. He schemes through rulers and authorities, dark cosmic powers, spiritual forces of evil in the spiritual realm. He's real. Your enemy isn't people who disagree with you, even though you want to write nasty comments to them on the internet. They're not your true enemy. The devil is. They're just being used by him. This is the context of our lives. As a church, we're in the midst of this battle, and as individuals, we're in the midst of this battle. So every morning when you wake up, I don't know, maybe you sit on the edge of your bed and you grab your clean socks for the day. I don't know, unless you sleep in socks, but that's kind of weird. But if you sit and you're putting on your socks for the day, every day when you wake up and you do that, you need to do that in the knowledge of there's a battle raging right now. A spiritual war being waged, being fought. Now you might be wondering, where is this war being raged? Where is it being raged? Well, we see here Israel faced an external threat, right? Israel faced, there the Amalekites were right in front of them. The threat came from outside of them. And in one sense, you and I, there is an outside threat, right? The enemy is influencing society and culture and government, all these kinds of things in opposition to the church. That's happening. We have an external threat. The enemy wants to wipe out the church. So it's outside of us, the enemy. But also what we need to see, and I'll show you from this text, the enemy is also inside of us. There's a war raging out there, but there's a war raging in here too. And the only way we'll understand that is if we look right before this story where Israel's faced with the enemy right in front of them. You got to look at them being led into the wilderness, being hungry and thirsty and grumbling and complaining and doubting God and testing God and quarreling with their leaders. There's a battle raging there too. And it just showed itself in the complaints and the quarreling and these kind. They were symptoms of the battle being lost within them. The battle manifested itself in the grumbling. Now we want to look for the outside enemies because they're easier to see and it's easier to point fingers out there. But I think we're called to realize that the battle starts here first. Here first. Might there be a lesson in here for us? Though the church of Jesus Christ will have opposition from without, the first obstacle we face is in our own hardness of heart. What if the greatest threat to the church in any generation wasn't the government, some other religion, a virus, or those who actively oppose true faith, but was lurking within us largely undetected? We want to say the church is at war with da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and we want the headline, the big banner, the big war that's being fought, but look at the subtle war. Look at the one being raged in our hearts. Look at how we speak the gossip. Look at how we quarrel with leaders, how we complain, how we grumble. Look at how discontented we are with what we have. Look at all these kinds of things. That's evidence of the war raging in our hearts. In the everyday stuff of life. A lot of people think our lives go the trajectory of one or two big decisions or big battles, but really it's in the everyday minute battles that all add up. It isn't just the big ones like with the Amalekites, it's all the little ones. So what I'm encouraging you to do is be aware we're in a battle. It's being waged out there, but it's also in here. And we need to be ready to fight. Now, who's going to win the fight? Is it all up to us fighting harder, trying harder to not grumble and complain and all? Is it about us just mustering up our troops? No, remember, just like Israel was no match against the army of the Amalekites, we're no match against the enemy on our own. Some of you like Where's Waldo books. You're familiar with them, right? You open the page, there's a picture, it's full of all kinds of stuff, and you got to look for the goofy guy with the hat and the striped shirt. These things frustrate me. Like, it takes me forever to find them. Some people can just go, boom, there's Waldo, I see him. In texts like this, I think we need to say, where's Jesus? Where's Jesus? We read this story, and the question for New Testament believers is, where's Jesus in here? So let me encourage you with this. In this text, Jesus is Moses on the hillside with his arms up in the air, being the intermediary between God and the people, interceding on behalf of the people before the Father. Jesus is Moses. Jesus is Joshua. Remember the name Joshua? Is the same name for Jesus that means salvation, God, Yahweh saves. Jesus is Joshua down in the battlefield fighting right beside us. Jesus is the staff. His finished work on the cross is the staff that when we look at, we're reminded of the power of God. And we know that no enemy can fight against us when that staff is being held high. When we're in the midst of battle, we can gain courage when we look up and we're reminded of what Jesus has already done for us, how he fought and he fights and he wins and he won. And Jesus is in the name, the Lord is our banner. Jesus is our signal pole. The cross is our signal pole that we as his followers rally around, that we go wherever he goes. He leads us in our everyday life. There's Jesus all throughout this text. So remember, in this battle, you fight, but ultimately Jesus fought and he won. He fought and he won. So when you look out at what's going on in the world and you think, this is crazy, the opposition that we're facing, remember, Jesus is fighting and Jesus won. He's fighting and he won. It's done. The enemy is desperate. Jesus is on our side. Take courage. Take courage. So one, there's a battle, right? It's spiritual, not physical. It's inside of us and it's outside of us. And Jesus, we fight, and Jesus fought, and Jesus won. And another thing that we get from this text has to do with the beautiful picture of Moses not being able to hold up his own arms, and Aaron and Hur coming and propping those arms up. That picture is incredible. When you think about it, it's absolutely incredible because it reminds us of how much we need each other. In this battle, we need each other. I'm convinced that one of the enemy's main tactics, just like it was for the Amalekites, is to take out the people on the fringes who are isolated. Take out the weak and the vulnerable. He goes after them first. He lures people out of community, and he gets them on their own so that, like a lion, he can pounce on that wounded sheep. And he's lurking around looking for people to pick off who aren't connected to anybody else. And that's a dangerous place to be. Because some of you may be saying today, you might be one of those people on the fringes, not in community, feeling like nobody knows you, and you might be saying, life's been hard. COVID has just kicked me in the chest. I feel like I'm all by myself, because COVID's really amplified the whole isolation thing, hasn't it? It took us out of our communities and put us alone in our houses in front of screens. Now you might be sitting there frustrated, feeling like you're losing the fight, and you're saying, I don't know how much longer I can keep my arms up. You need an Aaron and a Hur in your life. You need an Aaron and a Hur in your life. And alternatively, you might be sitting here today thinking, hey, I'm good. I'm weathering this thing all right. This battle, yeah, I'm winning. Things in my life are going good, but just know there's people who are saying, I feel like giving up. I'm not sure I will ever find a job. I'm stressed. My faith feels stagnant. I can't handle this cancer diagnosis. Whatever it is, they're done. And they're saying, I need somebody to come and help me hold my arms up. They need somebody like you to come into their life, to hold their arms up when they can't on their own. They need you to come into their life and say, I'm going to pray for you when you can't pray anymore. I'm going to stand in the gap for you. I'll keep praying for you when your prayers have turned into anxiety. I'm going to hold your arms up. I'm committed to you. And my question is, do you have people in your life like that? We need to be arm holder uppers, and we also need to have others prop us up when we need it. This is why we need each other, church. We need each other, and I think for far too long the church has been come to church on Sunday, have surface-level conversations with people in the lobby, feel connected there, and leave. But what this is calling us to is a deeper, more meaningful community, living as the family of God, being intimately connected with one another. And I'll tell you, there's no program that can do that. There's no program that can make community happen. It starts with each and every one of us knowing that we have a role to play in other people's lives. We have something to offer to the people around us. It might even be people that you don't know right now. So I'd encourage you, today or starting today, why not come to church on Sunday? Look around, say, I don't know that person. I want to get to know them because they might need an encourager. They might feel all alone. I can play a role there. And there might be some of you feeling like you're all alone and you need that person to come into your life and say, I'm here for you. I'm here for you. The Christian life is about so much more than just attending a service for an hour. It's a community of faith. When people are in the midst of the battle saying, hey, look up at the cross. You're feeling weary, let me remind you, Jesus did that for you. That's the church. Maybe you're not a part of any kind of a community or a group. I'd encourage you to do so. There's new gospel communities that are launching, that are looking for new people, that'll be launching in September, and some that are meeting throughout the summer. If you feel alone and isolated, come and talk to me, and I'd love to connect you with others. It's about you receiving, but about you giving as well. Women's Bible studies chats will be starting up again in September, October. That's another kind of community, right? It doesn't have to just be a formal community that the church does for you. Look for somewhere to get plugged in. So, let me wrap up. Band, if you could come up, please. Oh, 31 minutes, okay. In the spiritual battle that rages outside of us and inside of us, remember that Jesus is fighting for you and that you need others and others need you. Let's sing some more.